This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Michael Little. Today is August 29, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Little is joining me from Mission Viejo, California. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin by, if you don't mind, telling me a little bit of biographical information, when and where you were born, what your parents' names were, and where you grew up, that kind of thing.
Yeah, my name is Mike Little, and I was born in September 1946 in Northern California, a small town called Martinez, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. My parents are also native Californians, and my dad was in the Marine Corps during World War II. My mother was basically a housewife. Her name is Alta. My father's name was William. Had a very basic childhood. We lived in when I was younger, we moved to another town called Orinda, which is kind of over the hill from Berkeley, and had a really good, it's kind of a rural area at the time anyway, and had a great childhood, and eventually went away to high school in Berkeley, to a Catholic high school there, which was a little bit different since most of my friends were at the public school in the town that I was living in. And eventually, after high school in 1964, I went into college and didn't really know what I wanted to be or what I wanted to do, and so eventually I dropped out of college and volunteered for the draft.
Okay. All right. Before we get into your entry into the military, I'd like to go back a minute, if you don't mind, and talk about school and your education. It's one of those questions we just like to ask. What were your favorite subjects in school?
My favorite subject, when I eventually graduated from college in, was English, believe it or not. I mean, it wasn't something that I actually didn't enjoy reading until I went into the military. Maybe that's forced upon you because of the hours, endless hours of boredom. But it became reading and then eventually writing, and I haven't really stopped since. So I think my favorite subject in school would have been English.
Okay. And at the time that you decided that college wasn't for you at that time, were you aware of U.S. foreign policy at the time of what was going on in the world? How aware were you?
You know, I must have been aware. I mean, this is the mid-60s, and it was definitely in the news. Of course, it didn't have cable news like we have it today.
Sure.
I must have been aware, but I must not have really taken it personally or paid a lot of attention to it. When I volunteered for the draft, I didn't tell anybody, and when I finally told my dad about it, you know, they basically wouldn't talk to me for a week because he knew what it meant.
Sure.
But no, I don't think I really knew what it meant.
Okay. So when you volunteered for the draft, did you know that you would probably end up going to Vietnam?
Like I mentioned, I don't know that it was a conscious thought that, oh, my God, I might end up in Vietnam. Once I was in and at my first duty stations and things like that, yeah, you thought about it because some of the guys were coming back and joining the unit that I was in. And so then it became more personal.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like I was reading the paper every day and keeping up on events.
Sure. When you're... You mentioned that your dad didn't want to talk to you for a week after that. When he did finally talk, did he give you any advice? Did he tell you what to expect?
You know, I've been proud of his military service my whole life, you know, taking his uniform to school as a kid and hearing all the stories. He was on Guadalcanal, so it's rather, you know, famous events in his life. But he never really talked about his experience, and he never did till the day he died. So in a roundabout way, he didn't really give me an advice, basically, you know, the typical stuff, don't volunteer for anything, but really, no. It was very personal to him, and he just didn't talk about it.
Okay. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about basic training. Where did you go to basic training?
Well, you know, a Northern California native, I thought I'd be going to Fort Ord down there in the Monterey coast and loving it, but as soon as I said I do, they put me on an airplane to Seattle, SeaTac, and I ended up going to basic training, my first time away from home, really, up at the base there in Seattle, Tacoma, Fort Lewis, Washington, which was so different. And the thing that is my biggest in my memory is just the majesty of Mount Rainier. I had never seen anything like that in my life, and it was just one of those things where you would see it each day and just, you know, be mesmerized by it. I remember sending postcards home with that stupid volcano. It's just one of those, that's probably the thing that sticks out the most in basic training.
Okay. Could you tell me just a little bit about, at a, most people's basic training experiences are fairly similar, I would imagine. But could you tell me a little bit about basic, just a typical day?
Yeah, you know, it's drilling. I eventually became a squad leader and got a little bit of responsibility, whether I wanted it or not. A lot of physical training. Luckily, it was the time of year. It was like, I went in August, so you talk about early fall. So the weather wasn't too bad. Wasn't too hot, I should say. Dusty, I remember that. By the end of my tour, it was getting where the rain started, so it was getting cold and rainy. But mostly, you know, the drilling and then, of course, the firing ranges and the, you know, the physical PT and, you know, some schooling. But like you said, it's very typical. I don't remember being, you know, overly difficult. I performed pretty well in all the physical tests. I was, you know, a skinny kid that was strong, but... you know, you meet good friends, you make friends, and then, of course, you all get shipped off to different places.
Sure. Okay. And so from basic, you went on to advanced training to become an MP.
Yeah, and there's another surprise. I thought I was going home for leave, like most people do after basic. And they said, no, since it's close to the holidays, we're going to put you on a plane and fly you across the country. And, of course, I had never done that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I went to advanced training at Fort Gordon, Georgia. That's where the military police school was. Never heard of that, and, you know, never been into the South, and that was really different. Just the smell of the place, screen doors, all that kind of thing. But being that far away from home, I had one of those feelings, which is still is in me today, and that is I never thought I could get back home. It was so far away, so distant. I just, you know, airplane travel wasn't really common, and it just seemed like it was so far away, you know. That feeling of distance, I always remember that.
Okay. How did you end up being selected for MP training? Was it
remember taking a battery of tests as you do prior to, well, as you go into basic, the first couple of days of getting your uniforms and all of your equipment and then taking a bunch of tests. And I recall on one test, would you rather be a chaplain's assistant or a military policeman? And I, of course, put chaplain's assistant because I'd been an altar boy and thought, that'd be an easy job.
Right.
And the next thing you know, I'm in military police school. I have no idea why. maybe my height, maybe my aptitude. I'd love to be able to say that was it, but I don't have a clue why.
Okay.
Army's wisdom.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about MP training? Could you describe it for me?
Yeah, MP training is a little bit different than, of course, basic training. They treated you with a little bit more respect, obviously, because you're now a regular soldier. A lot of classwork, a lot of work on military procedure, filling out paperwork correctly, how to handle yourself on the radio, a lot of procedural, you know, like policemen on the street that you're more familiar with here.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of... you know, judo, things like that, so you can take prisoners in and not get yourself in deep trouble. But mostly it was just, mostly it was schooling. It was more schoolwork.
Okay. What type of classes? Could you tell me a little bit more about those?
Like I said, police procedure,
right.
How to arrest somebody.
Okay.
How to handle even traffic, you know, if it's like major traffic crossings or something, and, you know, how to get out there and wave people across, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I see.
Mostly, like I said, just, you know, what you would expect in any kind of a police academy type thing.
Okay. All right. Were there any memorable moments or anything that kind of stick out in your mind from this, from MP training?
Besides the weather being awfully cold, and I never felt cold weather like that before, being from the Bay Area, the one thing, and this is sounds silly, but I remember I got my first pizza. I didn't ever take a leave. Some guys would get a leave on the weekends and go into town, and those of us that stayed behind, they ordered pizzas to come in, like, you know, delivery pizzas we have today.
Sure.
And that's the first time I ever had a pizza.
Okay.
So I remember that.
All right.
And I remember meeting, for the first time in my life, I met three other littles. I had never met another little in my family. And I don't, we didn't know at the time if we were related, obviously, but they were all from the South, but it was kind of neat having somebody else with my last name.
Sure. Okay. How long did the MP training last?
I think, if memory serves me right, that was probably another 8 weeks.
Okay, another 8 weeks. All right. And did you have some some leave time there before?
You know, memory serves me right again. I believe I was assigned my stateside duty station. I didn't go to Vietnam from Fort Gordon.
Okay.
But I do believe I had some, leave time before I was to report to my duty station in the U.S.
Okay. And where was your duty station?
It was a little town outside of Dallas called Duncanville.
Okay.
Another thing I've never heard of before. It was headquarters for our missile bases in the area. You know, we used to have those Nike missile bases.
Right.
This was like the headquarters for that. We didn't have any missiles on site. But like I said, we were in charge of a number of areas around that in Texas. And the job of the MPs really was to guard the gate. So we had one gate guard on duty all the time. And to go to any trouble at the NCO club, it was a dry county and all the locals used our bar. And so the other duty we had was just making sure there was no problems at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Really rough duty.
Right.
And you had... I had a roommate, too. We had our own rooms, believe it or not. It was really nice. And I had a roommate that actually lived in the same area that I came from. So it was, we didn't know each other before the war, but it was kind of nice having a roommate that was, you know, another Californian.
Mm-hmm. All right. And how long were you in Duncanville?
I want to say 7 months.
7 months, okay.
Then he and I both got our orders for Vietnam at the exact same moment, and we actually went to Vietnam together and actually served in the same unit together.
Oh, wow. Okay. Let's see. So after 7 months, you received your assignment to Vietnam. What were your thoughts then when you received?
That was the first time I took it seriously. In that unit in Duncanville, a couple of guys had come back from Vietnam, so we got a little bit. They didn't have a lot of war stories or anything, but we got a little bit of what you might expect. I mean, Vietnam was so different for everyone, no matter where you were, but. So for the first time when I got those orders, I thought, wow, this is big. I mean, this is something I didn't count on, but it wasn't like a shocker.
Right.
But it was, you know, one of those things, well, hey, Little and this other guy, we know they got orders, so that became a big deal then.
Okay. That brings up a question I meant to ask you about your MP training. The officers who were training you at MP school, had they been officers that had come back from Vietnam?
I don't have any memory of that. There may have been a couple of NCOs, sergeants and whatnot, that did. But I don't have a recollection that they gave us a lot of, hey, here's what you better watch out for in Vietnam, like you see in the movies where infantrymen were being trained by, you know, veterans that had come back and watch out for this, watch out for that, or, you know, take care of business and pay attention. But I don't remember that much in MP school. When I, as an MP going to Vietnam, I thought it was going to be, and I don't want to use this word lightly, but I thought it would be kind of a safe thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not one of those deals. I knew I wasn't going to be pounding the jungle.
Right.
At least I hoped.
Right.
You know, things can change once you get there.
Sure.
But, you know, my visions of MPs were based upon what I had seen in movies and what I had been trained to do. Not, everything I was trained to do had nothing to do with what I did in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I was expecting a little bit of a easier go of it.
Okay. All right. Can you tell me a little bit about your trip over to Vietnam? And,
it was long, of course. The one thing that sticks out in my memory, of course, I went with my buddy, which was great, but one thing that sticks out to me is we refueled in Japan. I forget the name of the air base there, but getting off the plane, you would go into a little holding area and get a snack for, you know, about an hour while you're waiting for your plane to get refueled. And on the other side of the room were the veterans coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a totally different look, as you can imagine. And I always remembered that look and thinking to myself, I wonder if I'll ever get to be one of those guys.
Right. Okay.
I finally did. You know, when I came home, we stopped in Japan, and I got to be sitting on the other side of the room looking at the new guys.
Yes, sir. Did that change the tone of the flight for the rest of the way over there?
Yeah, it did. The difference was so radical. mean, not just in clothing, because they were more disheveled and they didn't have their nice stateside clothes on or anything. They weren't in their jungle fatigues, but they were disheveled and they had a look.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, well, that's the look I want to have.
Okay. After stopping in Japan, did you go straight from Japan to Vietnam?
Yeah, we landed in Cameron Bay.
Okay.
And then spent a few days there in the in and out, whatever they call it, the transitory process of getting orders and all the rest of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest memory I have of that experience was my buddy and I taking a shower together in the facility, and we were the only ones in the shower except for a half a dozen or so hooch maids, you know, Vietnamese women that had been hired as cleaners and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah.
And they were in the shower cleaning things and washing clothes, and here we are taking a shower. I mean, I felt so self-conscious because, you know, you're taking a shower.
Sure.
And you have all these ladies around, and it's like, geez, you know, are we supposed to be here?
Right.
Plus, we don't know. They're all dressed in black. And the only thing we've heard is, you know, the bad guys are wearing black. We go, geez, are these good guys or bad guys? That's how stupid you really feel.
All right. Upon arrival at Cameron Bay, what was your first thoughts when you stepped off the plane?
Well, it's like you've heard a million times, and it's so true. It's just the heat blast that you get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're in an air-conditioned plane. They open the door, and holy smokes. But it was really a stifling heat. And then riding in those buses with the mesh on the windows,
mm-hmm.
and you could hear noises in the far distance. It's just, you know, just so radically different than
right.
Northern California or Fort Gordon, Georgia, or Duncanville, Texas. It just looks so big and so vast.
Mm-hmm.
And so many things going on. I mean, luckily you're with a bunch of other people that are just as stupid as you are, so you feel, you know, okay about that. But you just feel, you know, really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So much to learn.
Right. Okay. And you said you were at Cameron Bay for just a couple of days.
3 days, 2 or 3 days, yeah. And luckily my buddy and I got orders for the same unit because we didn't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things can always happen. Transit base, so we got orders to fly up to Pleiku, which we did.
All right. How did you spend those 3 days at Cameron Bay?
You know, they put you on details, whether it was KP type duty or, you know, I don't think they had latrine duty. They might have. I don't remember, but just, you know, a little. Besides taking tests, if there was tests to be taken or shots or whatever, you just kind of menial details to keep you occupied.
Mm.
But we would try to dodge some of the details. You know, they'd ask for a formation, you know, and you were supposed to fall out in the formation so they could pick guys to do, you know, pick up the area, you know, just little things.
Okay. All right. So then you said you went on to Pleiku to join the 504th.
Yeah, B Company of the 504th.
Okay, could you tell me a little bit, before we get into the 504th and the mission of the 504th, could you tell me a little bit about Pleiku and the base? And
yeah, Pleiku, of course, was the central hub of the Central Highlands, very strategic. When I first got there, we were housed at our unit was housed at Camp Holloway, which was a famous camp up there, named after one of the first Americans that had been killed in the war up in that area. I forget his first name. Obviously, his last name was Holloway.
Right.
But it was that's where I spent my first month or two. But Pleiku was a definite, like I said, the definite center of the area. I don't forget which. I think there was a corps headquarters there, and it was 4th Infantry Division was there. Air Force, of course, had a big air base there, and there was a hospital there. It had everything. It was like the center. And it was along kind of a junction between Highway 19, which ran to the coast, and Highway 14 that ran up to Kontum and Dok Tho and places north towards Cambodia. So it was a jumping-off place for a lot of operations.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your own quarters there?
Yeah, I hated Holloway. Of course, I got there in the monsoon season, and it's wet and wet and wet. And Holloway, as I recall it, was kind of on a slope, and so you're always trying not to fall on your butt in this mud. And that we had hooches, which were just, you know, dirt floor or wooden floor, just mud everywhere. Nothing nice, no nice memories of Camp Holloway whatsoever. The bunkers outside, guys would relieve themselves in, so when we'd have incoming at nighttime or alerts at nighttime and you had to dive into a bunker for safety, of course, you didn't really want to because it was so putrid inside there.
Right.
Everything just seemed old and not rusty, but, you know, falling apart. Sort of like a prison cell at Alcatraz. All the weather just had been eating it up for so long, it was like crumbling. Just had and it was also the headquarters or the home of our helicopter units up there. And a lot of our guys on their days off would ride door gunner on the helicopters.
Okay.
Luckily, we didn't stay forever at Holloway. We moved to a new camp.
Okay. And the name of the,
moved to a camp on the other side of Pleiku called Camp Schmidt.
Okay.
No idea who that was named after, but we had wooden barracks, two-story barracks. I mean, it was the difference between night and day. We even had hot water eventually in our showers. We had actually, plumbing.
Right.
It was, like I said, it was new, and we were the first inhabitants, so it was nice.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the 504th MP Battalion and what it's...
504th is a very famous old unit that fought during World War II. And got deactivated, and then, of course, got activated again. The B Company was in Pleiku. They also had C Company and On K and A Company, I want to say, Natrang, I might be wrong. They keep, you keep moving over time. They would move companies or even headquarter units. Mostly, though, they were in the Highlands. B Company kind of had the same types of responsibilities as any other MP company. You know, you had responsibilities for town patrol, where you wanted to make sure the safety of American soldiers off duty, that kind of thing. That's what I expected to be doing, you know, that kind of policeman activity.
Mm-hmm.
You also had prisoner, take prisoners from one camp to another. Typically, the enemy prisoners, not our own guys, but enemy prisoners.
Sure.
And you had your typical motor pool people and your clerks, and you had your provost marshal's office that some of our guys would support that duty. What I did not expect, and I had never heard of before and had no training for, was when I went into, in the morning after we got there, my buddy and I, who flew together, walked into the orderly room, and the guy says, "We got two slots open, one on town patrol, one on highway." And I had no idea what highway meant. And my buddy said, "He'll take town." And I said, "Okay, I'll take highway." Well, that's when I found out there was a whole other aspect of the military duties in the Highlands, and that was to patrol the roads.
Okay. All right. And can you tell me a little bit about that mission of patrolling the roads? What was it?
What we did, and it was all, learn as you went. It was learn as you go. It was taking the lessons from a couple of the old guys that were... and, had been there months before you, and just, adapting. So what they did is they realized they needed all these convoys coming from the coast, bringing all this materiel for the war to this very strategic area. The enemy, of course, would try to, stop those convoys and intercept them and blow them up and attack them and all that. So they said, we need to have, besides the convoys needing to toughen up with their gun trucks, et cetera, we need to have military police out there, not just providing security, because we also had tanks and armor and all that, but to make sure, that downed trucks are taken care of and looked after, and, just all the kinds of things you can imagine would happen on an artery, bringing all this material up, not to mention the civilian traffic intermixed with it. So our duty was to outfit a Jeep. You took your old regular Jeep and put armor plating around it, so our motor pool guys would just, weld these things together. Throw an M60 machine gun in the back on a turret so it could swivel. So you had a driver, another person in the passenger seat, and a machine gunner. So basically three guys in a Jeep with a radio and a machine gun, and off you went every day. We would patrol typically in two Jeeps would be one patrol, and we'd have half a dozen or more Jeeps out on a 50-mile stretch of road going back and forth all day long as the convoys would come and go. And as they would get ambushed or break down or run into civilians, you know, anything that happened, could happen, did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was basically our mission. And then I learned from the old guys, and then when they went away and I became an old guy, I tried to pass on, you know, lessons learned.
Right. Okay. And what was your particular role?
Originally, I was a driver.
Okay.
I didn't have any experience on the M60. That I could have had that job, I suppose, but I became a driver, and I was very proud of my... I don't think I lost anybody with my driving, although I came close a few times. And then eventually, because, you know, after you are around a while, typically out on the road you'd have an NCO in charge, a sergeant, maybe a buck sergeant, which is a three-stripe sergeant, would be in charge of the road. Eventually, most of those guys disappeared. You didn't have many of them, so I was a spec four, and I became in charge of the road my last 3 months. So just, I think, because of my longevity.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been out there and seen everything, and they didn't have a bunch of sergeants where they could throw them out there. So me and another fellow, who both were specialists, fourth class, you know, we ended up running the highway. When I say running the highway, most of my time was Highway 19, which was Placo East. Towards the coast, we had about a 50-mile stretch of road before our sister company would pick up their responsibilities. You know, we'd meet them at a certain point.
Okay.
Each day we'd go out around 7 in the morning.
Okay.
The tanks would clear the road of all the mines, hopefully, that were laid the night before. And we always hoped that they found them all. Of course, they didn't, but that's the way it was. And then we'd get a notification around 7:30 in the morning that the road was cleared, and we'd be the first ones on it. We'd go about halfway in our area of responsibility and have breakfast while the convoys eventually reached our area.
Okay. What do you remember, if you don't mind telling me, about your first brush with combat, your first brush with first encounter with the enemy?
Hard to remember the first time. There were so many different ambushes and sniping incidents and mines. I guess the first one was an ambush, and the tanks were assaulting the tree line, and you know, we didn't want to get too close in with the tanks, but we were on foot, and I remember just being up an incline, a little hill, a rise, if you will, looking at the jungle, thinking, my God, how could you see anybody? You know, I had, at the time, we didn't have our M16s yet, we had M14, so I, you know, laid down some fire, but I didn't know what I was shooting at.
Right.
And I don't think the tanks did either, so I kind of let the tanks and the APCs do their business, and most of the ambushes, except for a couple of major ones, were hit and run, where they'd come down, shoot a few rockets into the trucks and or whatever, then bail out, because they knew that eventually they'd be in trouble. So that's probably the first time I remember, you know, somebody out there might be looking at shooting me, but I sure as hell couldn't see them. And that was the thing of my whole tour. I don't think I ever saw a bad guy, except prisoners, I never saw, or dead guys. I never saw a bad guy, you know, who was trying to hurt me. They were always invisible.
Right. How often would the enemy ambush your units on these missions?
I got to make it clear here, they never ambushed us.
Okay.
This was my belief, and this is what helped my fear every day, was they weren't after me. If they were, they could have had me anytime they wanted us. We were, you know, yes, we were well armed, but we were so open, and they could just wait, and they knew where we were going to be. We went places we shouldn't be. It was, you know, we were easy targets, but we weren't the targets. I always believed it was the convoys. You know, it was all the material and all that stuff, which they could never really stop. We were just there was too much of it. So I didn't feel unless I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, which that almost happened on occasion. You know, it really was. If I got hammered in an ambush, it was probably my own fault for being too close to it when it got started. So
they would generally let you guys pass by and wait for the convoy.
They did on various occasions. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, my guess is I never, and on all my trips back, I've never talked to an enemy soldier that was in the area. But my guess is they always knew where we were. They were they watched us. Mm. They probably thought we were more of a just like a fly on their back. You know, nothing that was really going to cause them a lot of pain. Not that we didn't inflict pain, but I just don't think that they had other things to worry about. There was a lot of tanks and, like I said, armored personnel carriers. And I could call up Phantom jets. I could call up Cobra helicopters. I could call up everything there was to come to our aid. And if I didn't do it, the tank units would. So, I mean, we had a lot of firepower on the road.
Right.
Not to mention the convoy's use of gun trucks and quad 50s. 50 caliber machine guns on a truck. I mean, they got to be pretty dangerous themselves.
Okay. All right. Well, would the ambushes on the convoys, would those be a daily occurrence?
Not daily. You'd have quiet times typically during the rain. The rainy season, nobody seemed to want to come out. I would say weekly something would happen. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's mines or hit and run. Major ambushes only happened a couple of times while I was there, where you'd have, you know, a large force, say 20 to 50 enemy soldiers attacking a convoy, blowing up two different ends of it so they could assault the middle, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And were the enemy, were they, I know you said you never saw them, so you may not know, were they local VC, NVA?
Or? We were always told they were NVA.
Okay.
And all the ones that I saw laying around were NVA. We used to, as a little side note, we used to patrol the road, Highway 14, Plaku to Kontum, and that was taking a convoy up in the morning and bringing it back at night. So it was a very structured environment, unlike Highway 19, where we were kind of like on our own, doing our own thing. But the convoy duty on Highway 14 was very structured. We took one up in the morning and brought it back in the afternoon. In the middle of my tour, they took that responsibility away from us and gave it to the 4th Infantry Division MPs, whom we were friends with. Well, in the first week that they were on that duty, they got ambushed. You know, the convoy got ambushed, and we lost, you know, a few MPs from the 4th Division along with about a dozen truck drivers. So it was just one of those instances where, you know, that you think about, well, hell, that could have been us, you know, up there.
Sure.
Just chance that we weren't.
Generally, when one of these ambushes would take place, was your unit always on call for support?
Absolutely, yeah. We were the first ones there. Mm-hmm. Well, it depended on where it took place.
Right.
If it happened to be close to where a tank was, that was a bad move. Mm-hmm. But typically, we would be the first ones there, or if not, you know, closely thereafter. We'll probably get to this later, but we were in a mountain yard village building a house, and the ambush was right next door to it. First, we thought we were the ones being ambushed. We weren't. It was the convoy, but it was right next door to it, so obviously we were the first ones there.
Okay.
It just depended on where it took place and where our patrols were.
Your area of responsibility on Highway 19, about how big of a, I mean, how many miles?
About 50 miles.
About 50.
Like I said, it was east from Plaku, and it went over the famous Mang Yang Pass. Now, that's famous because the French were wiped out there in 54, prior to Dien Bien Phu. They lost Group Mobile 100 up on that mountain, and we would visit their graves as often as we could. It was well up off the road up the mountain, and it was where we kind of escaped the noise and smell of the road. You know, we could look down on it. Probably something that was stupid to do, because like I told you, if anybody wanted to take out some MPs, that would have been an easy job.
Okay.
But then our area responsibility went past the Mang Yang Pass another few miles to a checkpoint where we would meet our sister company, and they would take it from there all the way into Ankei and past.
Okay. You mentioned a little bit about how the enemy would work and their ambushes. Could you elaborate on that? Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, they would use, depending on on the size of force and what their intent was. A major ambush would be something of with rocket-propelled grenades, B-40 rockets, whatever, in one location of the convoy, and then the same activity at another location so that they would cut the tail and cut the head of a convoy so that they could focus on the center of it. And hopefully they didn't catch some gun trucks or something else very nasty in that center part, because that would cause them trouble. But they would cut off the tail and cut off the head, and of course the trucks, instead of trying to, they were always taught to keep on moving. Of course they couldn't if a truck or two were blown up. You know, Highway 19, I call it highway, it's a narrow, barely passable, one lane each direction. So it's not a highway, and there's not a whole lot of room to maneuver off the road, and of course you go off the road at your own peril. So they would box up this number of trucks and then assault it, you know, with AK-47s and so on. And you know, you wonder, what's really the point of it? They would kill some truck drivers, wound a bunch of people, and they might lose a bunch of people too, but what were they going to do? You know, they couldn't really steal the trucks.
Right.
And to get the stuff off the trucks, if it was even something they could use, it, you know, it takes so long to do that. We would have reaction forces there so quickly that, you know, they couldn't afford to, you know, loot, for example. I mean, you know, they weren't going to be stealing frozen ice cream off a reefer truck or beer off a flatbed. You know, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
So I used to see, just think, you know, the futility of that kind of activity. Now, the harassment stuff, where they would have mines in a hit-and-run activity, which they did a lot, I can see that just as a way of pestering us and letting us know they're still there. But I don't really see how their ambush activity, if you will, really accomplished anything.
Okay. All right. Well, how would you, based on that then, how would you evaluate their fighting ability?
I have no doubt, you know, and I've read a lot since the war, but I have no doubt that their fighting capabilities were excellent. I mean, you know, they also, I'm sure, had tremendous motivation. You're there at the time, but you're not really being educated, or you don't really think in those terms. So a lot of what I know or what I can tell you are things that I've read and learned after the war.
Right. Okay.
But at the time, you're still just trying to get through one day at a time, you know, counting them off like everybody else does. You don't really pay attention to say, you know, you hear Charlie is bad, you hear Charlie could own the night and all that, but you don't see it firsthand. I mean, we were out there at night many times. One of our jobs was to close the road down at night, which means the last convoy goes by, you sweep behind it towards home to make sure there's no down trucks. Well, if there's down trucks, you're there until they're fixed. So we were out on the road till midnight, 1 o'clock many times, and you really sense the fear then of being at night. But you always in the back, like I told you before, I never believed we were targets. Well, I didn't think they knew where we'd break down.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought they weren't that organized where they could, you know, attack us, you know, effectively, not knowing that that's, you know, some place they could practice on. But it was definitely an odd feeling to be out there in the dark.
Sure. How often did you have these types of...
I don't even know. We'd have a lot of breakdowns, whether I was out there till midnight. I don't think it was weekly, probably monthly.
Mm-hmm. And
it got your attention, though.
Sure. And would you...
That was one thing that, you know, being on the highway platoon or highway patrol, whatever you want to call it, we were called roadrunners.
Mm-hmm.
And we had patches and all that kind of thing, and a lot of esprit de corps. We would always get in late. You know, and that, what I mean by that is that the mail call would be over and the chow hall would be closed. So it was one of those things, you know, you're proud of what you were accomplishing.
Mm.
Later on, you know, people did keep the mail room open. Later on, they did reopen the mess hall so we could feed us. But it was one of those things, you know, we had a dangerous job, and a lot of our guys in camp really didn't understand that.
Right. Excuse me. On these night missions, whenever you were working, trying to get the broken down trucks up and running again, did you ever have contact with the enemy then? I mean, happens.
No, luckily. That's why I'm able to talk to you now.
Right.
But what usually happened is we'd call their units, or their units would make their own radio contacts, and they would get these things called a wrecker. And the wrecker is just a great big tow truck, but it had a lot of capability. It was huge, and those kinds of folks could either repair the truck and get it the heck out of there, or they would hook it up and tow it out of there. At the same time, we would call in as many tanks and so forth as we could to kind of create a perimeter for us.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a very tricky business trying to mess with us in that kind of a circumstance. And like I said, from everything we knew, the enemy had always planned everything so carefully.
Right.
That this was not something they could plan for,
mm-hmm.
you know, a certain breakdown.
Okay. Did you have other missions besides patrolling the roads whenever the convoys came through and helping to get those, to get the broken down trucks off the road?
Yeah, that was our main thing. We would go up and down the road, and a lot of truck drivers, of course, and you can feel for them, and I have a lot of respect for those guys, because they're alone in a cab trying to drive a truck up these roads, which were dangerous in their own right,
mm-hmm.
let alone having enemy guys, you know, with trouble in their heart. So they would break down, and of course they would be afraid. So we would, anytime we'd see them, you know, broken down, trying to make repairs, flat tire, whatever it was, we would hang with them, just to kind of let them know, you know, they're not by yourself.
Sure.
And of course we would call medevacs in for wounded or dead, or call graves registration, because choppers wouldn't come in to take out the dead.
Right.
And occasionally, you know, when civilians would get involved, you know, whether we killed a civilian by mistake or an accident on the road, we would get involved in that. But most of the time, we would let the convoys do their thing. We weren't out there trying to get them speeding tickets. They had speed limits, and I never once, I'm proud to say, ever gave a ticket, even though we had to carry ticket books with us, if you can believe that. And occasionally we had commanding officers, I won't speak ill of them, but nobody dared come out on the road, but a couple of times they dared coming out in a helicopter trying to tell us that such and such a truck was speeding or going past the limit. And, you know, we'd have to fake it out and say, yeah, we'll take care of it.
Sure.
We basically were out there protecting each other, but, you know, any of the convoys needed help, we were there for them.
Right. Okay. Was there a typical protocol or a way to typically respond, the way that your unit would respond if a convoy came under ambush?
And this gets back to the training thing.
Okay.
Two things that I wish we would have had would have been training in that, because we always used to talk about, okay, what do we do?
Right.
We never had this training. You know, you come in like the Rat Patrol. That was an old TV series. That's about as much training as we ever got. That's what we looked like. And some of the tankers would call us the Rat Patrol. And we'd have scarves blowing in the wind and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, the protocol was get there as fast as you can. But after that, you know, do you leave the machine gunner on the Jeep? Well, no, you get him off, but who carries all the ammo? You know, all those kinds of tactical things.
Right.
We just winged it. It kind of depended on the situation. I mean, we had patrols actually caught in the kill zone of ambushes. And so, you know, we never were trained. What do you do then? Well, you just keep shooting until you don't have any bullets left. You know, I mean, there was no real protocol to it.
Okay.
No real, you know, hey, let's go out training today. We did have training on, okay, how do you shoot a 50 caliber machine gun? Okay, great, got that training, but I'm never going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There were times they gave us some LAW rockets to carry. And those were nice to have. They were easy to use, but, you know, how often do you get to use them? The biggest regret I have, and I think it's been corrected in today's military, is we didn't have a medic. We had a couple of Vietnamese policemen with us who could help interpret for us, but we didn't have a medic. We all had our own little first aid pouches, but no medic. And there was so many times when we could have bandaged somebody or had somebody with more expertise than a bunch of MPs out there who had the basics in, you know, medical care. I thought that was one thing that was really missing.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely surprising. I would have automatically assumed that there would be a medic with the unit.
No, didn't have a medic. The closest medic, out on that road, there was a place called firebase called Black Hawk, very famous firebase,
mm-hmm.
where the artillery and the armor units were. And that was the closest medic. So if I had somebody, you know, a friend or later on mountain yard friends that needed taken care of, I would haul them up to the medics there. Mm-hmm. But we had nothing with us.
Okay. All right. Now, were you always escorting American military convoys, or did you work?
Yeah. Occasionally there would be South Vietnamese convoys, but for the most part it was American. We didn't have much to do with the South Vietnamese, to be honest with you.
Okay. Did they have their own support, like a counterpart to you?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, occasionally you'd have a Korean convoy come down. You could have, you know, various other countries. But they basically took care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, you said you didn't have too much interaction with the South Vietnamese then, right?
Not too much, no. Except for our own, like I said, we had on our patrols, we would have a policeman or two,
right,
like to help interpret. There was, at one point in time, there's a river out there called the Ayun River, and the enemy had blown the bridge up, so we had a temporary one-lane bridge over the river.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have a patrol on each side to, you know, stop traffic when a convoy was coming one way or stop traffic when it was coming the other way,
sure,
so that they could get across the bridge. And for a while, the Vietnamese had a unit out there at the bridge for security, along with some Americans as well, but they had a big Vietnamese unit out there. And of course, boys being boys, you know, this happened about a week before I got there. We would take bullets and empty the, take out the round and take out the powder, put the round back in, put the powder on the top, secure it in the dirt and light it, and it would be like a little rocket. If you used a tracer, it'd have a tail on it. Well, we would shoot these little rockets at the Vietnamese on the other side of the road. And evidently, they got angry one day, and a big firefight broke out between the Americans and the South Vietnamese guarding the bridge.
Wow.
So, with those kinds of things, eventually they took the South Vietnamese unit off the bridge.
Okay.
It was all American units.
All right. From the contact that you did have with them, from what little contact you did have with them, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your estimations or your thoughts on the South Vietnamese.
Yeah, and it was all hearsay. And so I'm sad to say all we ever heard was how bad they were.
Right.
But that was hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw them in action. I went to their aid when they were under fire and saw nothing but, you know, exemplary behavior. But I didn't fight with them. Our interpreters were kind of cowboys, you know. They were just, you know, watching after themselves. They were okay. But I didn't really have any. Everything I thought was just stuff that we'd heard, you know, and the whole thing of guys holding hands, you know, and it was just so different to us. We were ready to believe whatever, you know. We were trying to get by. We were calling everybody, you know, slang terms that we probably shouldn't have been.
Sure.
But that was sort of embedded in us by the older guys.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't
sure.
Something we learned from firsthand experience.
Right.
My best Vietnamese friend there was my hooch mate.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a wonderful lady. She was a mother. And she and I became close friends from Camp Holloway, and then she moved to Camp Schmidt afterwards. And I always like to know whatever happened to her. But she was generally a friend.
Okay.
I mean, she took me and another buddy into her home, for example, which was kind of unheard of,
right,
to have dinner with her family.
Okay.
So it was just, you know, one of those things. But that's really the only experience with Vietnamese that I have.
Okay. All right, that kind of answers my next question, was your opinion on the Vietnamese civilians.
They just seem to get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not their fault. I mean, shoot, they're just trying to live and support their families. But, you know, you think about this, you're in the middle of a war. You don't know who the good and the bad guys are. You don't trust anybody. And, you know, everybody's in the way. I mean, in the middle of an ambush, you might have a big bus go by.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Lumbretta is filled with people. I mean, it was just, but it wasn't their fault.
Sure.
Things just happened, you know, among them.
Mm-hmm.
I had no animosity toward them. Like I said, I just didn't know many Vietnamese.
Sure.
There was one incident that I can tell you where I was truly moved, and that was an accident not far from Pleiku. It was a bad accident, and I'm terrible at paperwork, never filled out a report, so I called in the town patrol people to come out and handle the paperwork, which they did, but they only did because they said, but you guys got to stay there, because they were afraid to come out.
Right.
So we stayed. And a gentleman came up to me and said, would you come to my house? My father would like to meet you. I said, whoa, that's different. So me and two other guys, you know, loaded for bear, because we don't know who to trust and what to trust, went into this guy's house.
Sure.
And it was the only time I went into a Vietnamese home out in the road. The gentleman was an older gentleman. He'd lost his son, an Arvin son, and he wanted to have tea with us. So I remember sitting in this nice, modest home with this old gentleman who did not speak English, so we didn't have anything to say. And here, me and these two guys, loaded to the teeth, dirty as can be, you know, been on the road all day long, and I felt out of place.
Right.
Like, shame on me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we finished our tea and went on our way.
Sure. These accidents that you've mentioned, was this a fairly common occurrence, accidents between?
Yeah, and they could be really bad. I mean, you could kill 10 or 12 people at one time, you know, if you had that many people crammed into a Lambretta, Vietnamese, and if it ran into one of the American trucks, it could get very bad out there. We lost two MPs out there to that. I was the last to see them alive. Two guys came out on a joyride from our headquarters company, from our headquarters platoon, and on their way back, they ran into a bus, and they were both killed. So it wasn't just the Vietnamese that were getting killed in accidents. I would say we lost more people to accident than to military action.
Okay.
And that's just a function of a very bad road, very big trucks, and small, you know, civilian vehicles.
Sure, sure. What would the typical, if there is such a thing, typical American, the response, how would, say, if there's an accident between an American truck and Vietnamese civilians, how would it be handled?
Yeah, we would have to call out somebody. We wouldn't handle it on our own. We weren't really geared for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd call out somebody much higher than our authority, a provost marshal, or I don't know what the name of the unit was, that would come out and investigate those things, because they would have to make reparations of some sort. You know, we always knew that the families would be paid so much if they lost a person or lost cattle. And we had one MP go kind of crazy on us and kill a bunch of cows. And, you know, those kinds of things have to be investigated, and it was really above us. We weren't burdened with those kinds of investigations. We had to stay on the move.
Okay.
So we would have specialized folks that would come out. Like I said, I'm not sure what office they would be under, if it was a provost marshal or whomever, but they would come out and investigate, and then, you know, follow up. We never knew what happened afterwards.
Okay. Excuse me. All right. You mentioned in the veterans questionnaire that you were there. Of course, I know by the dates that you were in country, but for the Tet Offensive, can you tell me, did anything big happen where you were?
Well, we thought it was. I mean, of course, we had troubles on the road, and at times we couldn't go out during the height of it. But we would get intel every night, and intel would say, we're going to have these human wave attacks. They're going to come right down Highway 19 and come right through here, mm-hmm. through Camp Schmidt. And so we would spend, I think it was two or three nights, out of our cozy cots. We were out in a little ditch, lightly armed, I might say, you know, M60s and M16s, sleeping on the dirt. It was the only time I felt like a grunt, but sleeping in the dirt. Wondering if these human wave attacks, you know, with the civilians out in front of them, coming down the road, were ever going to take place, and they never did.
Mm-hmm.
The big battle itself was in downtown Pleiku.
Right.
And we could hear it and smell it and see the choppers and all of it, but we were not asked to go in to do anything about it. 4th Infantry Division had good intelligence prior to the Tet Offensive, and they were probably as ready as anybody was.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we did have a provost marshal's office downtown in Pleiku, and it got hit, and a lot of our guys, not a lot, but a couple guys got, you know, slightly wounded from that. A good friend of mine, I won't give you his name, but a good friend of mine was in town that night with his girlfriend, staying at her house when the Tet Offensive broke, and he opens the door, and the Viet Cong and the NVA are running through Pleiku, wreaking havoc, ready to attack the police stations and other things like that. They see him, they fire a rocket at him, blows up at his feet. He's lying in the street dying, and his girlfriend pulls him in and saves his life.
Oh.
that was one of the little side stories from the Tet Offensive.
Right.
Some of our guys, like I said, who were kind of caught in it downtown because of the provost marshal's office, had to fight their way out of that situation. But for the most part, the 4th Infantry Division and the other units, we would drive by the soccer field where there'd be maybe 100 or so bodies of the enemy lined up on the soccer field for all the photographers to take their pictures and stuff. But really, that offensive came and went. We also, at that time, were still patrolling Highway 14 to Khantoum, and Khantoum was hit really hard. You'd go to Khantoum and you'd see all the explosions in the buildings and the bodies out on the streets. We had a unit in Khantoum as well, a detachment. They lived at the MACD compound, and they were attacked. Nobody was killed. A dear friend of mine got hit in the chest. I tell him he's the only one who was ever hit in the chest by a 50 caliber bullet and lived. But the bullet had been fired from such a long distance, it hit the wire, tumbled, and hit him in the chest flat.
Right.
And knocked him about 20 feet backward. But for the most part, that, as far as B Company is concerned, I won't speak for the other companies because they did have some other activity, but B Company, really, we really didn't have a whole lot going on.
Okay. All right. How long I know this wasn't a part of your unit from what you just mentioned, but how long did it last in the area?
The Tet Offensive?
Yes, sir.
You know, I remember it as around 3-4 days.
3-4 days, okay.
Before everything kind of got cleaned up. Very tense after that, but that's my recollection that, Highway 19 got reopened. Highway 14 was running convoys again.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere 5 days or less.
Okay.
As I said, I believe, and I think I read, that the 4th Division did take the intelligence seriously and prepared,
mm-hmm.
where other units might not have.
Right. Okay. And were these primarily, of course, again, I'm asking you questions that didn't necessarily have to do with your unit, but was this primarily North Vietnamese troops?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
If memory serves me, but,
Okay.
I couldn't tell.
All right. Well, before we move on to the development of your relationship with the Monsignor children, which is something I really want to focus on, but before we do that, are there any other particular missions or incidents that stick out in your mind that you might be willing to talk about?
There's so many, and it's hard to pick one or two, or each one brings its own memory and feeling or emotion.
Sure.
I don't know that I can. I have the deepest respect and regard for the guys I served with.
Sure.
Sure, there was always a bad apple, somebody doing something they shouldn't be doing away from home, but for the most part, I was really proud of the guys I served with.
Mm-hmm.
Did we do everything right? Probably not, but.
Right.
I can't think of one special incident. You asked me, if you were ever caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. There was a real quick incident that I'll share with you, and that was at the top of the Mangang Pass.
Okay.
Some truck hauling cement bags must have lost some off the side of the road. Actually, they're on the road, so we stopped. Two Jeep gun patrol to get the cement bags off the road. We were also taking a guy from Pleiku to our sister company's place on the road so he could continue his journey to the coast. So I left one unit there to get the cement bags off the road, and I said, I'll take the guy down to the checkpoint so he can get it on his way home and meet the guys to take him, down the road. So as we near that checkpoint down the road, all these air explosions, are going off, and all these explosions around, and I'm thinking, well, it must be the tanks down there working out. But it wasn't. It was a mortar attack. And I always remember I was just a few minutes late, otherwise I would have been in the area where all the mortars were hitting. They were hitting a South Vietnamese unit. And I always thought, if it hadn't been for those cement bags, what would have happened?
Sure.
And so you have a lot of things like that where you think afterwards, oh, man, I was just 2 seconds away from that, or just a few yards away from this. One day a convoy commander's driving down the road in his Jeep, and there's an NVA soldier or a Viet Cong hundreds of yards away in some mountain somewhere, shoot some mortar round into the air, and it happens to land underneath the gas tank of the guy driving the Jeep.
Right.
You know, those kinds of incidents, you know, or just the randomness of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure. Well, by the time that from reading your short stories, and I know that your interaction with the Montagnard children really had a big effect on your life. But I don't want to put words into your mouth. But by the time that you met them, what was your mindset with the developments and how things have been going in Vietnam?
It wasn't so much how things were going in Vietnam as how much things were going inside me.
Right.
By the time I was lucky enough to develop this relationship you mentioned, I had really started. I had landed in Vietnam thinking I was a pretty good guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good little Catholic boy. Did most of the things that he was supposed to do. Obviously, joining the Army wasn't something my dad wanted me to do, but
right.
A pretty dutiful son, and always considered myself an upstanding, you know, telling the truth type of person. But by the time I got into about 8 or 9 months of my tour, I had seen and done things that I just lost sight of who I was.
Sure.
And I'm not talking about major atrocities, but small things.
Right.
Sometimes by non-action, you know, you feel guilty about things. And so I just was not... I wasn't pleased with who I was. It wasn't like I have to say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to be better. I mean, I just knew I was going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew it could get worse.
Right.
You know, you find out that everybody has this capacity within themselves for the good and the bad. That's what we always hear. Well, I never had seen it. And I kept seeing it, you know, witnessing what other people were doing, our side and their side, and then getting caught up in doing it myself. And I just didn't like that.
Right.
And then when the children became something that was an option,
mm-hmm.
or it just kind of fell into it, and if you ask me, I'll tell you how it happened, but
yeah.
That became my redemption.
Right.
And I basically quit the war.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that was, I know, from reading your short stories, thank you, that's really what I was trying to get at with the question, so thank you. That does bring up the question of how did you come about this relationship with the Montagnard children?
I mentioned the Aoun River and the two checkpoints on each side guarding that one-lane bridge, that temporary one-lane bridge. Well, we would spend a lot of time there, as you can imagine, because that's where our guys, they would stay there all day long,
mm-hmm.
monitoring that bridge. And so we would hang there with them and have lunch, you know, C-ration lunch and C-ration breakfast. Well, Montagnard Village was only a few hundred yards from there up the hill, and the children who were too young to work in the fields would hang down there, and say 20 of them. They would hang down by that checkpoint, hoping at the end of the day we would have some leftovers to give them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just there. They didn't bug us. They were very, seemed respectful. We'd always heard that the Montagnards were a very honorable people and not someone to mess with, but someone to respect. Once again, it's not out of personal experience I had with them. It's what we were told and learned.
Right.
The children, though, would sit out there and just wait and you know, hang amongst themselves. And the first time I saw Montagnards during my tour, I thought, you know, it's National Geographic time. There's no way in the world you can communicate with people that are living in the Stone Age, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid young American. Lesson number one, I was wrong on that one. But, you know, you just don't think that, you think the distance is, the chasm between the two cultures is just too wide to ever bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So for many months, you just look at, you know, you just, they were just part of the scenery. Until one day, you know, and the story I love to tell is my friend and I were just out of boredom. You're sitting there all day long, you know, you're a month after month, and you see so much, and you just get, eventually you get bored so much. You know, picked up a little rock and threw it, hit a little kid behind the ear when he wasn't looking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't something hurtful.
Right.
But it was something you would do with your own children to tease them.
Right.
And of course, they were too frightened to do anything back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're loaded, you know, more firepower than they've ever seen in their lives. And, oh my God, these big Americans and I don't know what they've been told about us, my God, because I'm sure that VC had lived in their villages. Mm-hmm. Until, you know, a couple of days go by, they get tired of getting hit in the back of the head.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I got one in the back of the head.
Right.
And it's too kind of, too much like a short story, but, you know, that kind of the light went on when that thing hit me in the head. Right. And all of a sudden, you start to learn how to treat each other as just another, you know, human being.
Mm-hmm.
And get to know each other and get to learn about each other. And that was the wonderful part about it.
Right.
And once that started, there was no going back. And luckily at the time, like I mentioned to you earlier too, this was a part of my tour where I was the boss.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have anybody telling me what to do. I was in charge of all the patrols. So if I wanted to go swimming with the kids or go build them a house or do whatever it is, or just hang with them, or just, you know, write down in my little book phonetically what their language was so I could learn it, or go up to their village and trade with the people and meet the parents and all that stuff, I was able to because I was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And my guys were gracious enough to tolerate me.
Right. How did the parents of these children respond to this developing relationship?
I'm very nervous at first. Because, you know, and here again, I'm so naive, I didn't know if my relationship would put them in harm's way. I'm just lucky that it didn't. That was pretty stupid of me. It eventually got the village chief killed, but yeah, I was naive, and maybe the bad guys didn't care. I don't know. But families at first were a little bit shy. One family in particular only had the mom, and she had four kids. And, of course, I eventually adopted them all, but they didn't have a father. He had died already. And they lived in the poorest shack in town. And that was eventually the family whose home we built. What really got them nervous was when I asked to bring them to camp with me.
Right.
Spend the night.
Mm-hmm.
They had never seen, you know, electricity or hot water, experienced that. Of course, we even had a television, so, I mean, that was going to be a big deal. And so I not only had to get their okay with it, the parents, but I also had to get our commanding officer okay with it. And eventually I did. I got them their TB shots and all whatever tests, whatever else they asked me to do. I got that all done.
Right.
So taking them into camp was a big deal. Once I got them back home and they told everybody what they saw, and of course nobody believed it. Just like going to the moon and say you saw, you know, whatever. The trust even grew stronger. And then, of course, we started doing more and more kids all the time coming into camp. We'd sneak them into camp, and it was wonderful. So the parents came around. There was also a time when we started to wonder about it. We'd pick the kids up at the village in the morning on the way down to that river checkpoint, and most of the time they'd just run out, jump in the jeeps, and away we'd go. We'd all have breakfast together. Occasionally, they would not come running to the jeeps. Well, after once or twice that happening and an ambush taking place that morning, we got to thinking, okay, the parents know the ambush is coming.
Right.
There was some intelligence there that they know to expect something bad that day, and they didn't want their kids to be with us.
Sure.
So we would say, okay, let's see. Today they're not running to us. Okay, be ready. You know, lock and load. Something's going to happen. Eventually, the kids overrode the parents. The parents eventually had no say in the matter. They ran every day. Didn't matter what happened. So the parents took a little winning over, but you know what? Especially when we started building the house, because it took so long to build that sucker, they got to know us pretty well. All the people in the village did.
Okay. All right. And you've mentioned building this house a few times. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
What happened was, like I told you, this family had no father, and they lived in a cardboard shack. Mountain out houses are usually built very nicely with bamboo and so on, and it's off the ground, and they're very neat, orderly homes. Well, theirs wasn't. It was just a mess. And she had these four young kids. I think the oldest one might have been 7 or 8. And we had a part on our road not too far away from that area called Dead Man's Curve, and obviously it got its name for what it was like. It was a bad turn in the road, and a lot of guys died there. Well, one truck driver was hauling lumber, and he killed himself there at Dead Man's Curve. And me and another guy looked at each other and said, let's build, the little boy's name was Gin, let's build Gin a house. So we stole all the lumber, that was after we took care of the poor truck driver, but we stole all the lumber, hauled it, Jeep after Jeep load up to the village, mm-hmm. and stored it next to their house.
Right.
And one of the amazing things, miracles of the war, was about a month or two later, when we finally get around and getting all the materials together to build this house, the lumber was still there. Most places in Vietnam, things would disappear, but
right.
but not there. So that's where the lumber came from. And then one or two of the guys in my unit had been, craftsmen in his civilian life, bricklayers and such, so they had the expertise to get this thing off the ground. And we got a lot of supplies, nails and cement and other things from Black Hawk Fire Base in our own unit. And we'd spent about a month or a month and a half building this house. And it was a daily occurrence where we'd go in there and, spend an hour or two while we're waiting for the last convoy or whatever, working on the house. And the villagers would all sit around and watch and laugh. They'd never seen hammered nails before. So it wasn't out of bamboo, it was out of wood, but
right.
it still looked like their house. The village chief told us where to put it and what direction to face it. And they had a big celebration after we built it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How many of the guys in your unit became involved with the kids like you?
Two other guys attempted it as much as me, but nobody as much as me.
Okay.
The two other guys were involved and had their, maybe three other guys. They each had their favorite kid, if you will,
mm-hmm.
where mine was maybe one or two or three, but it was a whole group.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have it wasn't a mascot type thing, but they'd have two or, each one of these guys would have a favorite child.
Sure.
They would always make sure they got, an extra can of sea rations, or we'd bring them in at nighttime or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, to some degree, two or three other guys that started a relationship, did they continue it after the war? No.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't continue it to this day.
Right.
But I don't know that anybody took it or felt it as deeply, mm-hmm. just because of who I was and where I was at that time, than I did. But like I mentioned earlier, everybody tolerated me. It wasn't something where I was putting our guys in harm's way.
Right.
Often almost all the time that we went into the village, and every time we worked on the house, I'd keep one or two machine gunners on their gun. Because, you want to trust people, but hey, it only takes one mistake.
Sure. Right. And do you know how these children or the Montagnards in general were generally treated by other Americans, or how they were looked at? Do you know anything about that?
I can tell you just about our village there. Most of the Americans, I think, were good at heart, but you always had some that had the devil in them, and I think they just didn't see human life the way I wish they had. There were some truck drivers, and I bet you there might have been some MPs I don't know about, but there were some truck drivers who would drive up that road and take that sea ration can they had on the front seat and fire it,
mm.
Throw it like a hardball at the kids.
Right.
Not to the kids.
Right.
And one time it cracked open the little boy's head.
Mm.
And, of course, they all call for me because I'm the one they can talk to, and I go up there, and he's got this huge gash in his forehead and tells me what happens. And I enjoy it. And this is, once again, a chance where I could have had a medic, but I didn't. So I took him to the fire base, to the Black Hawk fire base, and they stitched him up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you had those kinds of incidents. But for the most part, especially the guys I served with, probably because of me at the time, but they all treated the Montagnards with a great deal of respect.
Mm-hmm.
We'd had no reason not to respect them. They had never lied to us. I mentioned that ambush that took place right next door to the village while we were working on the house. Well, they had been all out there watching us working on the house. They didn't know about the ambush either.
Mm-hmm.
So I did ask about it later on, but they said, no, we didn't know about it either, and I trusted them.
Right, right.
So for the most part, I didn't see the American interaction. They're just driving by. There's not a whole lot of getting to know people.
Sure. Well, you mentioned being able to speak with the children and trying to learn the language. How successful were you when you were there in Vietnam as a soldier?
Pretty successful. To this day, I'm still saying the same phrases to them. And we all laugh because that's all Dad knows.
Right, right.
That's all he's been saying for the last 40 years. But, you know, we have our little repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it hasn't really expanded because of space. But
right.
When I was there, we'd have, I'd take it like Outdoor Life and different magazines, and I would point to things and tell them how to say it in English, and they would tell me how to say it in their language.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of the boys were really good students and really were good at learning and at teaching. So I wrote everything down in a black book phonetically, phrases, words for things, stuff that we would use every day. And, of course, their names I wrote phonetically, and none of it was written correctly.
Mm-hmm.
They had a written version of Angels We Have Heard on High, that wonderful Christmas hymn. And it was in their language that the French missionaries had given them. And they taught me to sing it in their language, in Benar. And I still have it. So those kinds of things where we could sing a song like that together, or just try to pick up as many things as we could so that we can converse. Because there was no interpreter. We didn't have a mountain yard interpreter.
Right, right.
And they didn't speak Vietnamese. So.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind me asking, you seem to focus a good bit on your relationship between two boys. If I can pronounce their names right, I'll probably get them wrong, but Ken and Pratt?
Perfect.
Could you tell me a little bit about how the relationship with those, how it became special with you, with those two boys in particular?
It seemed to be, those were the two boys I hit in the back of the head.
Okay.
So they were about 5 or 6 years old. They seemed to be the leaders, if you will, if they had such a thing. And they were the most intelligent, and Pratt was light-skinned, which always made me wonder if he didn't have a little French background in him.
Mm-hmm.
Highly intelligent. I always thought he'd be a piano player, where, again, he was so strong, such a powerful guy.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought he would have been the athlete if there had that chance. And they just seemed to have the spirit. I don't know what it was that made them stand out any more than the others, but they loved me and vice versa. And, they were the first two kids we took into camp, got the permission for. And then, of course, they would come every time. After that, I didn't ask permission. I just kept bringing them in. I don't know why they were my favorites. I knew them all, and I loved everybody, but they seemed to stand out. Pratt's father was an alcoholic, so he had a rough life. Again, his father was dead. He was one of the little kids who just had a mother.
Right.
And they were just special. And I go swimming with them every day in the river. Me and about 20 kids, while the tanks are watching, and barbed wire's up river, so they can't float mines down on us and things like that.
Right.
But they were just special. I don't know why it was them. Maybe it just had to be somebody, but they were.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to continue discussing this relationship because I know it continues to this day. But before moving on to your relationship with your Montagnard family, before continuing on to that today, I'd like to talk about leaving Vietnam. And the end of your tour, and then get back to your relationship. When did you receive orders to leave Vietnam?
This is my recollection.
Okay.
I'm on the road. I knew my time was getting short. Guys that I knew had already gone home.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the road, and most guys left the road with a month to go, and they would go on fence duty or guard duty, if you will, at nighttime, just to keep them off the road. I refused to do that. I didn't want to leave the road. So I was on the road, knew I was getting short. They call me up on the radio and say, hey, your orders came in. This is your last day.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine what that feeling's like if you've been counting, 365 days.
Right.
They said, this is your last day, on the road. You're going to be processing out in the next day or two.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at the top of the Mangyang Pass, you know, waiting for that last convoy to go by, so we would sweep in behind it, thinking this is the end of my day.
Right.
And I've got another gun jeep with me, and all of a sudden, on the opposite side of the pass, the side where I wasn't going to be going, all hell breaks loose. All these explosions, and oh my God, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? There was a pump station. They had built a pipeline, if you will, if you can believe this, all the way from the coast to Pleiku, pumping gasoline. Every night the enemy would blow it up and we'd fix it. But there was pump stations along the road, and pump stations where they would pump that thing up the hill, I guess. I don't know. But there was a lot of American stations there, and occasionally they would get hit. So that's what I thought was probably happening. But all these explosions, and all my guys, of course, lock and load, and ready to get down there, right?
Right.
I hesitated.
Mm-hmm.
I all of a sudden realized, I'm going home tomorrow, or pretty soon thereafter.
Sure.
Do I want to go down there? And they looked at me, you know, they called me by my name, and I finally looked up and chambered around and said, let's go. So we went down there, and luckily we didn't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But that was how I found out I was going home, and that was my most embarrassing time, where I almost said, no, I'm not going to the ambush or whatever it was.
Right.
Because I'm going home.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But they weren't, and they wanted to go, and so we did.
Right. Okay. And as you learned, after this, when you had learned that you were going home, how did that affect your thoughts about it? Well, did you think a good bit about, you know, about the children and what would happen to them? And
yeah, during my last couple of months, I'd also started a clothing drive, so all my parents, and a bunch of other guys' family and parents sent box load after box load of clothes over there. So we were constantly handing clothes out in the village, and always said it was the best dressed Mountain Yard village in Vietnam. But on the way back that day, I stopped and to say goodbye to them. And the one thing, and if you read any of my stories, the one thing I didn't know how to say back then, or maybe it was just because I was too macho, is I didn't know how to say I love you.
Right.
So when I said goodbye to Ginn and Pratt, I just shook their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at me, and they knew what it was about because they'd seen other soldiers go home. Or, you know, they don't come back.
Right.
Home is kind of obscure to them, but they know they don't come back.
Sure.
And so I just shook their hand and put my head down in the jeep and closed my eyes, unhooked the radio, and left.
Mm-hmm.
Not fully understanding how that would affect me later.
Right.
You know, you're so wrapped up in yourself at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't wait to get out of there. I mean, that's what you've been counting for.
Right.
And you didn't expect a relationship to build up. And so, you know, I just basically shook their hands and said goodbye and went and left and never came back out on the road.
Right.
Once I did get home, I spent a year trying to go back.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote and applied with every NGO, you know, non-governmental, every religious, every you name it type of non-military organization to take me back.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would take me. I was going to go back and go back and be with the kids.
Right, right. Okay, so, again, not to put...
What I did when I got home, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what I did when I got home, some of my guys were still there, obviously, so I would write letters to them, and I would write letters phonetically for them so that they could go out on the road and tell the kids, you know. My name back then was T, short for TT, which is short for little, or pigeon English for little.
Right.
Anyway, you know, the T, here's words to you, here's his pictures for you, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They would take pictures of the kids and send them to me. So that I was able to stay in touch for maybe, let's call it 6 months after I got home.
Okay.
That way. Of course, I keep sending clothes and stuff like that. But once my guys rotated out, and eventually even our unit rotated out of there, and there was absolutely no contact.
Okay. All right. Again, like I said, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but so would you say that you pretty much had some mixed feelings leaving because of your relationship?
Yeah, it was one of those things. It's going to be too simple sounding to you, but, you know, in the Mountain Yard culture, bracelets are a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I got right away from a Mountain Yard boy named John is a silver bracelet in 68, and I still wear it, and I've never taken it off. And it's one of those things, I used to wear more than one, and I'd have, you know, three or four on that, and I'd jingle. But when I got home, those bracelets acted as a reminder. And like I said, I've never taken it off. And I took some home movies while I was there. I've got 9 minutes of home movies from a Super 8 movie camera that one of my guys got for Christmas. And so I have film of them. And so when I got home, I went out and bought, not a projector, I couldn't afford that, but I got a little, like a splicing machine, cheap little splicing machine that had a little tiny viewer on it. And I would just run the film through it, right, just so I could see them.
Right.
So I'm honored, privileged to have that as a memento. And I also, for Christmas, my parents sent me one of those little small reel-to-reel tape recorders. And when the kids were in one night, I taped them, so I have their voices on tape.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to them and singing that song I told you about and stuff like that.
Right.
So it was, not a day went by that I didn't think about them.
Mm-hmm.
For the 26-year separation that we had.
Right.
And they were always a source of hope for me. You know, it's when I knew I was the best I was.
Mm-hmm.
In a time when I was the worst I was.
Right. What type of reception did you receive when you upon arriving at home, between your family and the public?
Yeah, troubled. Probably a common theme, but I had trouble leaving Vietnam. I got bumped off a couple of flights at Cam Ranh Bay, so it took me 3 days, and I was about ready to shoot somebody. You know, I hadn't slept in 3 days, and I had a girlfriend when I went to Vietnam, and we had kind of broken up during my tour, but you know, when you hang on to something when you get home, you think, well, maybe there's another shot at it. So my biggest regret was I didn't go home. We were living in Sacramento at the time. I didn't go home. I went to San Francisco, and she picked me up.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to her parents' house. Realized right away, well, that was a big mistake, because she was actually living with somebody else.
Oh.
So my parents came down the next day and picked me up. I feel bad I didn't go straight to their house, but be that as it may, you know, coming home, I came home a different person in that I was very much independent. My plan was not to live with them in Sacramento, but it was to go back to Oakland where I had worked before, get myself a little apartment, you know, nothing major, but heck, I'm 21 years old at the time. I just thought that was, you know, a natural thing to do. Well, they thought something different. They wanted their little boy back.
Right.
And they thought I was on drugs, and they didn't talk to me for a week when I joined the Army. Well, it was more like a couple of months after that. During this time, they thought I was a drug addict or just crazy. You know, why would I want to go live in Oakland? Why wouldn't I not want to live at home with them and do what they wanted me to do? And so I left. And it was a real strained relationship, if any at all, between myself and my parents for 6 months after I got home. Later on, I tried college, and they seemed to warm to that, and we kind of got back together. But then I dropped out of college after a week, and they just kind of, you know, accepted me, I guess, at that time. I sold everything I owned, got two suitcases, got on a Greyhound bus to go see the guys I served with, because I missed them. And at least my dad came to the Greyhound bus station that time and didn't get angry with me.
Right.
I don't have any recollection of bad feeling towards other civilians or anything like that.
Right. Okay.
A few minor incidences in Oakland, but nothing big. You know, going to a party and people say, oh, you're a veteran, or, you know, Vietnam veteran. You know, a couple of odd looks and this and that and the other, but nothing that I can point to as what we've heard about other people getting spit on and stuff like that. I don't have any recollection of that.
Sure.
First thing I did when I got out of the Army, Fort Lewis, when I came home from Vietnam, I also rotated out of the Army at the exact same time. First thing I did was take a taxi down to downtown Seattle and get civilian clothes.
Mm-hmm.
My haircut probably gave me away, but I got civilian clothes.
Right. Okay. Let's see. So, overall, would you say that you had a good bit of difficulty readjusting?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know how much I want to blame on Vietnam. Most people say, you know, I might be crazy before I went to Vietnam, but in Vietnam surely put a hiccup in the whole process. I still didn't know what I wanted to be.
Mm.
The trip going back to look for all my buddies didn't turn out as well either. I mean, they were going on with their lives, and they weren't in the same place as I was anymore. So
right.
It was some good and bad on that whole experience. I got home, and like I said, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I ended up driving for the Red Cross. I would take cancer patients to their hospital for their treatments, but that was voluntary. So I just kind of, you know, didn't really have a whole lot of focus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And when you returned to the States, did you have more time to serve in the military, or were you out and finished?
I was finished, yeah.
Okay.
You know, you're on inactive reserve or whatever they call it, but yeah, I was finished. I actually got out about 10 days earlier than my due date.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a break for about 10 days.
Okay. All right. And,
I just celebrated my 40th anniversary. I got back on August 5th.
Okay.
68.
Before we get back into this, whatever you reconnected with Vietnam and reconnected with your Montagnard family, could you tell me a little bit about life after Vietnam, your career, and how life has gone after Vietnam?
Yeah, you know, it was evolutionary. It was never a plan. I went back to junior college, and then it was a special program. At the time, I was also working in the school district in Sacramento as a security guard at a high school. It was a program that it would take so many Vietnam veterans and put them through college, you know, if they wanted to become a teacher. So I tried that. Eventually graduated from college, but I didn't really want to be a teacher. And I think to be a good teacher, you have to want to be a teacher. So I kind of drifted, not drifted much, but my dad was in the food industry and said one day to me, you know, I never thought about following my dad or anything. He said, there's an opening with Coca-Cola. Would you like to have an interview? Because, you know, he dealt with them. So I said, sure, not knowing what the heck that meant. So I did, and I ended up working 26 years for Coca-Cola as a, like, a business analyst, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A lot of number crunching and so forth, a number of different positions, but that was pretty much my role, mostly in Northern California, a stint at headquarters in Houston, in Southern California, and after 26 years, I eventually retired from Coca-Cola.
Okay. All right.
So it was kind of evolutionary. It wasn't that, you know, I always wanted to be A, B, or C, and then that's what I became. It kind of evolved.
Okay. All right. And one thing I meant to ask you before moving on to that was, did you follow the war fairly closely after your departure?
Yeah, I did. Not fanatically as far as the media,
mm-hmm.
but I could not get enough to read book-wise. I became an avid collector. This is the day before computers, so I worked with a lot of bookstores and agents that, you know, I was trying to find, via the post, you know, via regular mail, you know, trying to find the books. What books are being written about it? You know, there wasn't even a bibliography. So I couldn't get enough books, and to this day I'm still the same way. I don't care how many I've read. My collection is, you know, say 700 or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
I could not read enough. It was like I had to know what just happened, you know, to me, to the country, to there, you know, everything. It didn't matter what the topic was. Really appreciated the novels more than the others, but I just couldn't read enough. So, yeah, I followed the war, but I also became a student of it.
Right. Okay. And what did
I still have the newspaper from the day that Saigon fell.
That was my next question. I was going to ask you, what were your thoughts or what do you remember about that day?
Yeah, just sadness, you know, and all the waste
right.
on everybody's part.
Mm-hmm.
Numbness to it.
Okay.
It was really sad to watch it, you know.
Sure. Did your adopted children come into your mind on that day?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
You know, when the Americans left probably in 73, and, you know, my unit had left that area long before that, so, I mean, the door had already sort of closed, but mm-hmm. once the country became what it became. That door was, you know, for me, I thought there was no way that it was ever going to be reopened.
Sure.
In my mind, and I always had felt this, because my children would come to me in dreams for all these years, and I'd say the only way I'm going to either see them is going to be in dreams, or maybe, you know, if I die and get lucky enough, I'll be able to see them after that. But
right.
You know, there was never any hope. And there was absolutely no way of getting information about that area of the country.
Sure. Okay. And that brings me up to reconnecting with them. Can you tell me how that came about, how you came about being able to reconnect with them? And
when the embargo, U.S. embargo, was lifted in 1994, some travel agent that I had dealt with before called me up and said, "Hey, the Highlands are open. Would you want to go?"
Mm-hmm.
And God, my heart jumped out of my throat. I said, "My God, yes." So I got one of the guys I served with, one of my dearest friends from New York, and he and I got tickets in 1994, and just armed with some old photographs and, you know, no hope really.
Mm-hmm.
We went back together. A newspaper man accompanied us to do the story. Like I said, pure luck and lining up a few stars and a few miracles. You know, the photographs proved to be, you know, what was needed to find them, and we did. And they were, most of them were still alive,
mm-hmm.
living in the same general area, pushed back more into the jungle, but we were able to reconnect.
Right. Okay. And what condition were they in? I mean, basically, how had they been treated over the years by the government that you, or did you
Yeah,
know?
Like I said, they were moved into the jungle area, so the,
right.
all the prime real estate along the road was taken over by either Vietnamese hamlets or communities or rubber plantations. There's a lot of plantations there now, so you don't really see the mountain yard villages like you would have in the 60s. So they moved into the jungle. Subsistence farmers, no electricity, no running water, tough life, everything's controlled. They weren't restricted on the number of kids they could have. Most Vietnamese are restricted to two, because of their high mortality rate, they were not restricted. They need people to work in the fields. Saw a little bit of signs of some education maybe going on, but that was 94. Things have changed a lot since then, obviously, and depending on who you talk to, I don't want to get into a political discussion about what's going on in the Highlands today, but
sure.
just my family, the people I see that I deal with, because through letters and visits and so forth, their lives seem, albeit difficult, seem to be improving each year.
Mm-hmm.
As we become part of their lives and kind of giving them some of the tools better themselves, they seem to be doing it.
Right.
Life is still tough. There's uprisings over there. I've had a couple of family members put in jail, and they're out now, but they're in poor health. I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be fixed, but they're able to go to school. Of course, they need to learn Vietnamese. That's the dominant culture. But oftentimes, they can't go all the way through school or meet their potential because of conditions at home.
Mm-hmm.
A parent needing them to work in the fields, that's still very much part of the culture.
Okay. On that first trip, go ahead.
I was just going to mention that, you know, the difficult part has been since 2001 when they had the first major uprising in the Highlands, the Central Highlands, by the mountain people. And that's really put the Vietnamese on edge, the authorities. And, you know, up until 2001, I could go out and visit them in their villages. I could also receive phone calls from them that they would make collect calls. Since that uprising, it's really been made things very difficult. We've never been to the villages, back to the villages. And we communicate now mostly through letters on the mail. And I have some Vietnamese friends in Pleiku who are able to actually email me with some of their letters.
I'd like to go back, if you don't mind, a little bit to that first trip back when you were able to finally see them again and finally reconnect after all those years. Could you tell me a little bit about, I mean, just a little bit more about your own feelings? How did it feel to finally be able to do this, to reconnect?
It, was one of those situations that was totally unplanned. But we, like I said, we were armed with those old pictures. It turned out an old Vietnamese gentleman who lived by that bridge I keep telling you about on the river said, "Yeah, I remember those kids. Can you believe it?" You know, he says, "Yeah, I remember them." And he pointed towards the jungle. Well, I, you know, wanted to take off running, but my guide and my buddies knew we got to do this, you know, the right way. So we drove out there, found this village. And the people just came, you know, there were no people in the village at the time. It's their daytime, they're out working. But news travels fast. The first Americans in 26 years are here. And so they all come running into the village, and I pass the pictures around. And, you know, I'm talking to, you know, my little bit of Binarnat language, and this is really neat, but I haven't seen any of the kids I knew yet. All of a sudden, out of the crowd, a woman shrieks, and she's one of the little girls in the picture. And so we have our wonderful reunion, and I say, "Are Ginn and Prot alive?" And she says, "Yes, but they live in the village, you know, kind of next door, if you will, a ways away." So we set up a time for the next day for me to come out and be reunited with my kids. So that's what we did, you know, in this person's house. And so we, my buddy and I went out there, and we went to the house, and of course nobody was there yet. But we're sitting there and having a cup of tea with the girl that I had, who recognized herself in the picture, waiting for something to happen. And of course, the whole village is there. People, you know, clamoring to get a view. And the next thing you know, that mass of people parts, and in walks Ginn and Prot and two other of the children I knew. And I probably wouldn't have recognized them if I hadn't known they were coming. But since I did know they were coming, I did know who they were.
Right.
It did 26 years. And that reunion, I don't think I'd ever cried that hard.
Sure.
Both of us. And I'd always wondered if the kids would have remembered me, let alone the things that we talked about and did and all the rest of it. They had the clearest memory, and they knew everything, remembered everything, the old songs, everything.
Right.
So it was quite a reunion. We were able to spend the whole day together and a little bit of the next, but that's how it all happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how many times have you been back to see them?
Total of 8 times back.
Okay.
Have not been allowed to see them on each one of those trips back. We've had a few disappointments. My son and I went back in 2004, mm-hmm. and we were in Nha Trang on the coast, getting ready to go to the Highlands the next day to spend days with our family up there. And the second protest took place, coincided with our trip.
Mm.
And so the Highlands were closed down immediately, and of course they thought I had something to do with all the whole thing. And we had a little trouble getting out of the country, but
right.
And we had instances like that since that 2001 protest, and now the 2004, where it's just been difficult to get permission to go see them anymore.
Mm. So when was the last time that you were actually able to see them?
In 2006, I visited. I went back by myself. My wife was tired of going back and being disappointed, and I didn't want to take my son through it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back alone in 2006. Thought I had all the prior governmental approvals. Our ambassador had helped me get into the country. I wanted to, you know, spend 3 days with the families, not necessarily in the villages, maybe in Pleiku, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, the first thing was all the local authorities made me go into a meeting with them, and then what they eventually came up with is they granted me 1 day with 20. Now the family right now is 182 people strong, and they allowed me to see 20, so I had to make a list of 20 people that I would get to see for, you know, 1 day.
Mm.
And that's what we had. We had a reunion of 1 day with 20 people.
Mm.
And I tried to go back in 2007, but was denied. Once again, I got arrested coming out of the country in 2006. They got me for fraudulent, but filling out my visa application incorrectly. I always put tourist. I just figured I'm a tourist, but they said, "No, you're not a tourist because you helped so many people. You're a humanitarian. You filled it out wrong." Therefore, I had to sign a confession to that extent. I'm sure that's why I'm not, you know, able to get in now.
Well, are you? I'm sure this is probably a dumb question, but are you still actively trying to get back over there, I'm sure. Right?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I take it one step at a time. A couple of other organizations that I might be able to go back under their umbrella, if you will. And I'm going to be retiring soon. I'm going to have more time to focus on my quest to get back and to see them again. It's so difficult to get the authorities to believe you, you know, and to trust you. I got to try to find a way to make it in their best interest to allow me back in.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's a pretty good story. So, yeah, I'm still actively trying, and not a day goes by that I don't miss them and
sure.
think about them.
Okay. Well, I know that you mentioned in the veterans questionnaire that you hope to retire there one day. Is that probably not an option now?
You know, it was until 2001. My wife and I had even looked at property. That dear friend of mine who got blown up during the Tet Offensive and saved his girlfriend, saving his life, actually has married a Vietnamese woman now and built a house in Hue.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been jealous of the fact that he's able to do that. Of course, he doesn't have the Mountain Yard connection, which is the killer.
Right.
But he's got a house in Hue, and I just so envious. But yeah, that was always my my target, at least to spend half the year there
mm-hmm.
each year.
Right.
But that looks like that's probably not, unless something happens here drastically, it doesn't look like that's going to take place.
Okay. Let me ask you some broader questions about the war and about your experiences. One other thing I wanted to ask you, this is a fairly broad question, so you can answer it any way you like, but overall, how would you say your relationship with your Bonar family has affected you? I mean, I know it's had a great effect on you, but could you put that into words?
A couple of comments there. I hope I can remember them both. But I go to various functions or been a part of different activities or exhibits or reunions or whatever it may be, interviews by the media. They always say, "This is you have closure, you know, this thing of closure." And I try to explain to them, but I don't think I'm very successful. I said, "There is no such thing as closure. Certain things have been put back in the recesses of the mind that need to be put back there. They can come out at any time. But really, Vietnam is alive for me. It has never been closed. It's always been part. Anybody that's ever met me know I'm not living in the past. It's alive and well. And I love the country, love the people. Don't ask me why, but it's part of that connection that I made in 68. But it's alive. It's never been over, and it won't be over.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, part of everyday living. Now, the other thing I was going to mention is that without the war, I never would have had my family.
Sure.
So that's kind of a contradiction, but, it, you know, in some respects, I have to say I'm thankful for my experience over there. I don't hate it. Luckily, I didn't, you know, lose a lot of friends or have the worst assignment in the world, if I was fortunate. And I was fortunate to make a connection to the locals. A lot of people never did that. So I'm grateful for it now. And, you know, I always say, you know, without Vietnam, I wouldn't have my family.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say my family, I don't just mean a bunch of people that I kind of, you know, hung out with. They are, in my heart, adopted. And they know it. And when I found them in 94 and wrote them a letter and said, "Yeah, I'm so happy I found my dear friends," they wrote back and said, "No, you're mistaken, Dad. You found your children."
Right.
And it was kind of a shock, I guess, you know, that they were to perceive me that way. That's how I perceived them, but I didn't want to be, you know, overly forward.
Right.
But they're, you know, they're a part of me and always will be. The sad part is, and I didn't mention this, but when I found the kids in 94, in 95, Prot died,
mm-hmm.
and in 97, Ginn died.
Right.
So they were both, you know, under the age of 40, and they passed away. And I always thought to myself, well, you know, if I hadn't have found them, they never would have died. Because
mm-hmm.
in my mind, they always would have been those little children.
Right.
So you have to be careful of what you wish for. But anyway, I still have a relationship with their widows and all their children.
Sure.
So for me, Vietnam is never gone away.
Okay. All right. You also mentioned, and I actually...
Jason, can you speak up a little bit, or is it my phone that's going down?
Sorry, can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. You also mentioned, and I meant to ask you this a little bit earlier, your role in the orphanage. Could you tell me a little bit about that? And your...
In the last wonderful visit was in the year 2000. My wife and my 7-year-old son at the time went back to Vietnam. During those days, we were unrestricted, which meant we could go visit our family, and we did. We had a great time. But to answer your question, one day we went up to Con Tum. And you know, I told you I used to patrol up to Con Tum. I've always liked it up there. And my guide that day said, hey, I want to take you to the old Catholic church. Well, there's an old wooden church in Con Tum that's been there 100-and-something years, built by the French. Mm-hmm. And at the old church is a location also of an orphanage. And it was on Easter. And Easter Eve, the Mountain Yards were allowed to have their mass. It was an outdoor mass, about 10,000 Mountain Yards, and my wife and I and our son. And we had his first Holy Communion, and like I said, that was Easter Eve. It was nighttime mass. It would last about 4 hours. Mm-hmm. The next day was Easter, so we went back to the church. I knew the parish priest. He's a wonderful man. That's another story, but he's a wonderful man. And I wanted to go back and see him and thank him. And it just so happened all the orphanage, all the orphans of all ages were there, and my son, we had a bunch of candy with us, and he handed out candy to all of them. And a lot of them didn't know to take the wrapper off because they hadn't had candy before, but he handed all the candy out like we do in our country with the Easter Bunny.
Sure.
Well, to make a long story short, one of the little girls who was about, I don't know, two at the time, two or three, comes up to my wife and holds her hand. Well, my wife is a very sensitive person, and at that moment, she adopts this little girl, and vice versa. So we get home, and you know, we take the pictures, we get home, and I write the family, and I said, you got to go back to Con Tum, find out more information about this little girl. Who is she? Give me some more scoop. So they do, and then since then, we've sponsored her. We can't bring her home. There's no adoptions allowed. So we sponsor her each year. That just means we fund her care. And all of that, myself and other veterans who have found out about this orphanage, because it is kind of a tourist place now to go see that church, we've kind of come together with this group called Friends of Vinh Son Orphanage, and that's the name of the orphanage, Vinh Son. And we are in our third or fourth year of fundraising and sponsoring and paying for projects from education to basic needs to computer skills, sewing classes, tractors, you know, all that kind of thing. And it all kind of, for me anyway, it comes out of that one little Easter morning when a little girl came up and held my wife's hand.
Right.
She's in fifth grade now, and we have a relationship with her, so it's really a special little thing. And I went and saw her in 2006, and she, you know, she hadn't remembered me. She'd seen new pictures, but she, of course, was too small the last time she'd seen me.
Right.
That's the story of the orphanage.
Okay. All right. I guess before we close the interview out, some of these you've already touched on, but I have some broad questions about your experiences in the war and just your experiences in Vietnam. If you could answer, and you can say as much or as little as you like about them. But could you tell me about what was your opinion on American policy towards Vietnam and Southeast Asia during the war, and I guess, and has that changed over time?
A lot of people have asked questions similarly over the years. You know, was it right, wrong, indifferent? And really, as a soldier at the time, you know, at night we'd kind of, as we were cleaning our weapons and stuff, there wasn't a whole lot to do. We would occasionally try to get into discussions about good, bad, or indifferent, and you know, none of us seemed to really, I hate to say that we were just dumb old soldiers, but we really didn't have a grasp on the political or the, you know, we just didn't see tangible evidence in our eyes every day of this was the right thing to do or what we're doing here has a purpose. We didn't see that.
Right.
We saw our purpose amongst ourselves, doing our job the best we could for the truck drivers and everybody on the road, and also for each other. It was always about that, and I'm sure that's a common feeling. We didn't see an end game, or, you know, it wasn't like we were reading the newspaper. We might have got stars and stripes, but we never, we, we never did see anything that kind of fed our thought process or one thing or another. So during the time there, very little of that. I mean, it was mostly day by day, counting our days off, and, you know, laughing as much as we could, finding, you know, relief for all the tension or the boredom. Once I got home, or in later years, like I said, I've done a lot of reading, and I think it was maybe it was a righteous idea to help the South Vietnamese, but I think the tactic and the, you know, the strategy that we used to go about it was probably flawed. I'm kind of more of a believer of John Paul Vann, who kind of suggested that it should have been more of a smaller scale, you know, kind of fought the same way that the guerrillas were fighting. That it couldn't be done with large American units. It had to be more small, tactical, you know, advisory type effort. So I go along with that. It was probably done incorrectly. I mean, you can say the same thing today. I mean, it's not uncommon to hear the same talks about Iraq.
Right.
But, you know, I was always put off two things, treating our veterans poorly, and I was never a big activist either. I didn't like to see so many of our veterans protesting the war during the war. I wasn't a big fan of that. I wasn't totally against it, but I wasn't a big fan or participant in that. So I had mixed feelings about it all. I mean, like most complex things like that. Like I said, during the war, I just a stupid grunt. After the war, I tried to listen and read as much as I could. But I don't know if we know the answer.
Right.
To what is Vietnam or whatever.
Okay. All right. And
kind of a long-winded response, but it's something I still struggle with. But I think we probably went about it wrong. Was it right or wrong? You know, I've been to the wall a number of times, and I see what the sacrifice made by so many and wonder what for.
Mm-hmm.
And I maybe haven't seen the answer to that yet.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, just another few of these broad type questions, but for you personally, what would you say the legacy of the Vietnam War means to you?
I'm sorry, Jason, I'm having trouble hearing you there.
Okay. For you personally, what would you say the legacy of the Vietnam War is for you?
The legacy for me?
Yeah.
I guess it is what we mentioned to you earlier.
Right.
And that it, the legacy for me is that it's given me a family. It's given me something outside myself. It's opened the world to me. I mean, I'm not just worried about my son and daughter living here in Orange County in Northern California. I have this huge world. Is it always easy? No, it's not. I get, say, 7 letters in a week like I did last week, and so many of them are full of pain and tough business. So, you know, I still burden Vietnam is still on my back every day.
Right.
But I don't say that that's necessarily a bad thing.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you would like to say or comment on before we bring the interview to a close?
I don't think so, Jason. I think we covered everything pretty good.
Okay.
I mean, obviously it's a topic that I think about a lot and probably could talk about for days over a cold beer or something, but you know, it's complex. But for me right now, it's just pretty simple. You know, to take care of the family as best I can.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Jason.
Let me stop the recording, and if you don't mind, I'd like to talk to you for a few more minutes.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but I will go ahead and bring the interview to a conclusion now.
Thank you.